because you live on charity, you have to look after things. And you can't just think, oh, it's just an old hammer and leave it out in the bush to get rusty without putting it away. That's not caring for things. And probably you know this. Sometimes the people are really poor, maybe that's you. You haven't got much money, but you decide out of faith to buy a hammer for the monastery or for the nuns' monastery so they can make their buildings. You do that out of faith, and that's really a big... So some people, that's a big lot of money. And monks just leaving it everywhere, not caring for it, that is not good enough. And I was like that. I really gave a hard talk to all the monks. Now, in the hall at Bodhinyana. And usually, you know, the way I give talks, people smile and they laugh and they get sort of relaxed. But this time, all the monks were dead straight. If I want to, I can do that. They were just so scared. I was really blasting them. And when I finished the talk, you know, about looking after things in the monastery, you know, people were just... I went out of the hall. I was really disappointed. Because I thought that whoever did that, why on earth didn't they put their hand up and say sorry? Yeah, maybe I was a bit too hard on them. Maybe they were too scared to say sorry. But still it disappointed me because I expect very high things from monks. You know, okay, you left it out there. Say sorry. Don't do it again, okay? I made my point. But not one of those monks in the hall confessed. And I went out feeling really disappointed that the standard of honesty was, you know, not high enough for me. And as I went out the hall, I suddenly figured out why none of those monks confessed. It has slipped my mind completely. I was the one who left the hammer out in the forest. It was me. And I'd totally forgotten about it. It was blank. And only when I was thinking, why did they say, oh God, I know why they haven't confessed. It was me. So I turned around, went back and said, please sit down for a moment. I finally figured it out. Has that ever happened to you? Of course it has. And so one of the nice things is, I get it wrong sometimes, you get it wrong sometimes, life gets it wrong sometimes. So this is where we learn how to embrace imperfection in your meditation, in the hall, in the surround, in yourself, in others, because this is real life. Many people, when they are born and they grow and they have positions of authority and power, they want to improve things. It's nice to improve things, but realize you can't improve things all that much. Instead, we learn how to accept things and embrace things and laugh at the silliness of life and laugh at just the way that people have all these ideas of what life should be. And when we have all these ideas of what life should be, we find we have all these ideas of what meditation should be and how I should be. And that is a problem for your meditation. But when you make peace with this moment, allow it to be. Then you find when you're sitting here, you get so peaceful and so content. You get so blissed out. It's not just a happiness. You figure out, why did that happen? And you realize this, how to be at peace with life. How to let go of cravings. And why that does lead to the end of suffering. The way you meditate, what works in meditation, in this room, in this compound, is exactly what works in life. If you want to be happy and at peace, if you want to create a beautiful world, a kind world, then learn how to create a peaceful mind in meditation. And if you can do that in your meditation, you can actually solve so many problems now in life. One of the great teachings in meditation, which I haven't pointed out except in a few interviews because many of you have heard it many times, but it is the most powerful, or one of the most powerful teachings in psychology from the Buddha, which works so well in meditation, which works so well in life. And now the idea of embracing is another form of loving kindness meditation, and that is a simile of the monster coming into the emperor's palace. I say this on every retreat. But I haven't actually mentioned it in the public talks during this retreat yet. The monster in the emperor's palace comes in, the emperor is away. monster goes and sits in the emperor's throne because people are too scared to try and stop the monster. And as soon as it sits in the chair, all the guards, ministers, servants in the palace, they got very angry. Get out of here, you don't belong. This is not your chair, this is our emperor's chair. Get out of here. And at those few unkind words, the monster grows bigger, more ugly, more smelly, more of a problem. And that just makes them more irate. And they threaten the monster. They sort of shout at it, scold it. But all the scolding and all the argument and all the shouting and all the threats, the monster just grows an inch bigger, more ugly, more smelly, more offensive. And by the time the emperor comes back, this monster is huge. And for the last couple of times, just to make it make me very popular with the majority of people in this room, the emperor, she says, instead of get out of here, she says, welcome, monster. Thank you for coming to visit me. Has anyone got you a cup of tea yet with a nice biscuit and condensed milk? Or would you prefer... It could be a Sri Lankan monster. Or would you prefer green tea, peppermint tea, a glass of water? And the empress was sincerely kind and welcoming. And what happened next was every kind word, kind deed or kind thought, and the monster grew an inch smaller, less likely, less smelly, less of a problem. And that meant that everybody could see what was going on. They realized their mistake and they realized the solution. So they all came around being kind to the monster. Foot massage, neck massage, getting it something to eat. And every kind act or kind word, even kind thoughts, the monster grew an inch smaller every time. Until the monster was back to the size when it first came in. But they carried on with the kindness even then, until the monster shrank to such a small size. One more act of kindness, and the monster vanished completely away. And that story, you may find that story in the Udana, part of the Tripitaka, in the Kudaka Nikaya, taught by the Buddha. And there he said, we call those monsters anger-eating monsters. They feed on ill will. That's what makes them worse and bigger and more of a problem. And there's so many of the obstacles in meditation are anger-eating monsters. And are your thoughts. Get out of here, thoughts. You don't belong. Even sort of negative thoughts. Get out of here. You don't belong. Even thoughts to people in the cottage. Get out of here. You're too noisy. You don't belong. You find that when you have anger towards anything, it gets worse. It gets bigger. It gets stronger and more of a problem. Which means that when there's a noise in the meditation hall, we say, welcome, noise. Thank you for visiting me. When there's a pain in the body during the meditation, welcome pain. Thank you for being here with me. And whenever there's any tiredness in the body, because you know maybe you're sick or you're not so well, whenever there's any problem or difficulty in your life, instead of saying there's something wrong here, someone to blame, if not someone else, it's me to blame because I've been stupid. Instead of doing that, you say, welcome. So I welcomed my stupidity of leaving that hammer out into the forest. And I told everybody about it. I even wrote it in a book. I welcomed just my faults instead of trying to hide them and instead of trying to even change them. It's just part of being a human being. You do forget from time to time. And when you welcome these things, you find the faults get less. When you welcome the sounds, they're not disturbing you anymore. When you welcome even the aches and pains in the body, you learn how to live with them and accommodate them and be at peace with them. And they're not a problem anymore. You find the problem of life, the suffering, is nothing to do with the world outside. It's always our reactions, how we react to things. Which is one of the reasons why that I mentioned in an earlier talk, to focus in meditation and in life on the second factor of the Eightfold Path, the right intention. This is where things start from. To have thoughts of making peace, being kind, being gentle. And I really emphasized this many years ago, when a meditator who would often come on retreats got very sick. And they came up to me and said, "It's really awful, Ajahn Brahm, I can't meditate anymore. I can't sit down, my leg's in a plaster or something. And I can't meditate. What should I do when I'm sick?" I said, "What do you mean you can't meditate? Can you make peace, you know, with your illness, with your situation? I can make peace with it. Can you make peace with anything? Can you be kind? You can always be kind to things. Can you be gentle? Yeah, so you can meditate. That's all meditation is. Putting in right intention, and everything else follows from that intention. So if you can make peace, be kind, be gentle, you know, when you're meditating here, instead of trying to change things and manipulate things and get it just so, you find that life is so simple and so easy. You make peace with things, you're kind to it, you're gentle with it. And that is always within your power. You can't always get people to stop coughing. You can't always get people to check in their mobile phones before they come to the retreat. You can't always stop people keeping biscuits in their room at night time, whatever else you keep in there. But what you can do, you can always make peace with people and be kind and be gentle to them. You can't always, you've been trying, some of you, for the last few days to control your mind. Does it do what you want it to? You sit here and say, "Right, this is it, I'm going to meditate now, I'm going to be very peaceful." And it doesn't work. Because you can't control your mind. You can't control your body. You get sick, it gets tired. But what you can always do, you can control your intentions. You're always able to make peace, no matter what's happening. You're always able to be kind, no matter what you're experiencing. There's the famous simile of the saw by the Buddha, which really raises the bar almost to impossible heights, but people can do this sometimes. The simile of the saw by the Buddha was saying, and when I read it, I was like, "Wow, I don't think I can do this." He said, If some bandits or thieves, and no gooders, they grab hold of you and they torture you by sawing you off limb by limb, not with a chainsaw, that's quick, just with those old blunt saws you may see in your husband's garage. Saw, 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 saw. And the Buddha said, if someone is doing that to you, sawing your arms off and then your legs, if you have one, even just one moment of ill will towards your torturers, you're not a disciple of mine. That's what the Buddha said. Oh, that's a bit tough. That's a hard ask. But when he said that, this is incredible. Can that be done? And it can be done. People do it. It's amazing. Just, you can always have the opportunity to be peaceful and to care and let go. That is in your power. Don't forget that. And the Buddha said, if they're doing something like that to you, one moment of ill will, you're not a Buddhist, you're not my disciple, then imagine when they slam the door at 1 o'clock in the morning in your cottage. Please remember the simile of the saw. If you get one moment of ill will towards that person who mindlessly, selfishly slam the door. Are you really following the Buddha's teachings? The Buddha said, no way. And so when he raised the bar so high, all this other stuff in life, all the irritations of speech, of actions, of other stuff, you can let it all go. You can always make peace, be kind, be gentle with anything. And I love that when it gets to with my mind, my stupid mind. It's like sometimes my mind slams a door on itself and makes a noise when it doesn't need to. Has a thought which is totally unnecessary. Has a tiredness which is not really I don't know why you're tired. Is that sloth and torpor? But instead of arguing with it, when sort of my mind is not going properly and it's like my mind is being tortured, I don't have any ill will towards my mind. Because I can always make peace with it and be kind and be gentle. And I realize that's the path. There is something which, a little teaching which, again, it's using different parts of Buddhism, putting them together and getting a very potent little message and insight about karma. Sometimes we think of karma as just what you do outside of meditation, but there is something I like calling meditation karma. So, you know, in the Buddhist idea, the law of karma, if you want to be happy, healthy, rich, whatever, you know, it's your karma. You have to make the karma to get those things. So what karma do you have to make to get, say, jhanas, to get insight, to get enlightenment, to get peace and happiness inside? There's a karmic cause for that. And the Buddha said again and again, the essence of karma is right intention. Chedanahang karmang vadami. I just say that to impress some of you. Because I sometimes say all these stories and they think, oh, that's very nice, that young Brahmin invents this by himself. He doesn't actually relate it back to the Buddha sutras. And I do know those Buddha sutras. And I know the Pali. And this is saying that intention is karma, said the Buddha. You know, he made that statement really emphasizing that intention is the essence of karma. So what is right intention as far as meditation karma is concerned? It is making peace with this moment, being kind in this moment, being gentle. And you realize that if that is your attitude with every moment of meditation, so that's what you're actually doing. Because we say, what should I do in meditation? Should I watch the breath? Should I get rid of defilements? What should I do? Ajahn Brahm, give me something to do. And so I say, just this is what you do in every moment. Make peace with this moment rather than making war with it. Be kind to this moment, no matter what it is. Open the door of your heart to this moment. Don't judge this moment. You have a thought, a feeling in the mind, please embrace it. Make peace with it, be kind with it, and be so gentle with it. With making peace, being kind, being gentle, if that's what you're doing in every moment, you are not only practicing the second factor of the Eightfold Path, which is a critical one, you are also making good meditation karma. Which means it's only a matter of time before that meditation karma bears fruit and you get these great meditations. Why do you get these great things? Because you've done the karma in the past to give rise to these things. Why do you get lovely meditation? Because you've been making peace, being kind, being gentle for such a long time. Now you get your paycheck. And for those of you who don't know this simile, I've told it to a few people during the... I told it in one of the talks, I think just in the interviews, about the fellow working on the building site, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, never got paid. I think that was just in the interviews. There was a migrant came to Australia, a poor guy, and he got a job in the building site, and he went to work on Monday, worked very hard, and at the end of the day, he came home empty-handed. Wife said, how much did you earn today? He said, nothing, I never got paid. He went to work on a Tuesday and a Wednesday, the same thing happened. Worked hard all day, come home, how much did you get today? Nothing. And he thought, I'm not going to work in Australia anymore. They work so hard, you don't get paid at all. But, you know, wasn't doing anything on Thursday, so went there just in case. Same thing happened, worked his butt off, no money. And on Friday, say, I'm not going to work anymore in Australia. They just exploit you, us migrants. And they just work hard. They don't pay you any money. But his wife forced him to go to work on Friday. You know what happened on Friday? His boss gave him a big paycheck. And he went home and he told his wife, I finally figured out how it works in Australia. From now on, I'm only going to go to work on Fridays. Now that's what people do in meditation. They think, now I've got a really good meditation. I'm only going to go to meditate on good meditation days when I get paychecks. You don't realize that sometimes all those meditations, you're sitting here and struggling and not getting anywhere and just sitting here and waiting, and it doesn't really happen. That is like going to work on Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday. You don't get the paycheck. You're making meditation karma, building up the power of your letting go, your kindness and your gentleness. You're building it up. And it's incredible. You don't know when it's going to happen. All of those of you who had brilliant meditations, they come out of the blue. You can't predict it because you can't see how much good meditation karma you've built up. And the time comes, you've got so much good meditation karma, you're sitting down, and I don't know why this happens. Wow, this is really peaceful. This is really joyful. Yeah, this is great. And you think, okay, now I know how to meditate. You think, just go to work on Fridays. That does not work. You get the insight here that much of the things which you get in life, you don't get immediately. You build it up after over a long period of time. You know, your health, your wisdom, your financial security, that's something you build up. Meditation is the same. You build it up after many, many, many hours of sitting down there and getting nothing, but you build it and build it until you've got enough good meditation karma. And I have that you get the good result. And I have such faith in the law of karma, being a sort of Buddhist for such a long time and understanding how the mind works and how these things work. I understand karma so well. I have this 100% trust in it. I know if I'm going to do a good act, a good deed, an act of kindness, I know there's going to be a reward coming. Not immediately, but later on there'll be a reward coming. If I'm kind and generous to somebody, I know it's going to sort of come to some sort of fruition. I just, one example, it's an example of somebody else instead of myself all the time. There was this guy, he used to come to the Friday night talks. And he came up to me one day and he said he had his own little business, a one-man business. They're just making enough money to get by, but not being rich, never be rich. And unfortunately, he'd just been through a divorce. As I said the other day, in Buddhism, we don't call them divorces anymore, we call them recycling. It's a much more positive word, isn't it? Because divorce, recycling, that's positive, you know, recycle your parts. So anyway, he'd just been through recycling. And he said one of the things, because he had to move into a small apartment, they had to split their assets, he had this beautiful pedigree dog. And he couldn't keep the dog in the apartment, so he had to find a nice home for it. So he advertised and he found this really nice old lady who also had a dog of the same pedigree, so they could actually get on together. And the old woman would like a friend for her dog, and this man had a nice home for his dog, so it worked out really well. And so that's how he got to know this old lady. The old lady, she had a couple of dogs, and she lived in the suburbs of Perth, but she couldn't drive. And so public transport in Perth is not very good at all, not like in Bangkok or London, you know, where you can go anywhere very easily. Without a car, it's very difficult to get around here. So, you know, he offered, look, if there's any time you need anything to go into town, just give me a call. I've got my own business. I can just take an hour off whenever I want. And so she would phone him maybe once a month or something to be taken to the doctors or the dentist when she had an appointment in town. And he told me he really actually liked this. It was just an hour off work, you know, to do something good for somebody else. He really enjoyed it, you know, looking after somebody. But then he said what happened one day. He said, she gave him a call at the office. Are you free this afternoon? I've got to go into the Perth City to do something. He said, yeah, sure. I'll come and pick you up. So where do you want to go? I have to go and see my lawyer. I'm sorry. And so he said, okay, I'll wait outside. He parked the car outside. He said, no, would you mind coming up with me? I need you to do something. So he said, okay, must have to witness something or something. He went up there to the lawyer's office, and there she signed all her assets over to him. She made him the beneficiary. And she said, I had no family, no one looks after me, but you've been kind to me. And she was an incredibly wealthy woman. And so he didn't need to have his business anymore. A simple act of kindness like that. He never intended to make any money out of this. But this is what happens. You are kind. You look after other people. It's making good karma. It has to come back on you sooner or later. And it usually comes back so many times over. And in this particular case, you know, he could retire. And for you, you keep making good meditation karma, making peace, being kind, being gentle, forgiving all the people who make these noises. You know, forget about, you know, there's no food left or it's late. If you make good karma like that, it's going to come back on you. And it's true, you can't control other people, but you certainly can control your attitude towards them. You can always make peace with them, forgive them, be kind, be gentle. You can do that to yourself as well. And understanding that is understanding what meditation is all about. You make peace, be kind, be gentle with every moment. And so, because you're making peace, you have incredible amounts of peace in your heart. I mean, really deep peace. Sometimes I despair. People want to be peaceful, but they don't want to make peace. They thought they can buy it or they can just demand it. I demand my peace. Like some of your children might demand pocket money. I demand an allowance, Dad. No, you've got to work for it. You've got to do something to get something back. The same with peace. Peace is not your birthright, which you can just demand. You have to work on it and build it up. And the only way you can find peace is by making peace in every moment, or as many moments as you possibly can. And of course, you know, it will work. When you make peace in every moment, you have a huge amount of peace. I call it just building the house of peace. You know, I was looking after this construction project here. Forget how many years it took to build Jhana Grove. They're always adding a bit here or changing a bit there, maintaining it. It's always work in progress. But, you know, it just took such a long time. And you could see the workers, one brick at a time, this hall was made. And now we have a beautiful hall where we can meditate in. And just like the house of peace is made one brick at a time, just one moment of peace, making peace with this moment, not fighting and not trying to change it, you know, having a ceasefire in the war between, you know, you and yourself. They're trying to make yourself something else, trying to improve yourself. Please have a ceasefire in the war of self-improvement and make peace with yourself. And if you make peace with yourself so many times, you get so much peace. You're building it up. You get the house of peace. You can sit there and you're very, very happy and very content. And you deserve it because you made it. It's karma. So it's not something you do through willpower and you say, right, I am now going to meditate. I'm going to stop the thoughts. Thoughts, stop. You're laughing because you've done that. And it doesn't work. You know, you can't just demand peace. You've got to build peace. You know, you can't just think that I'm now going to make silence. Silence takes a lot of work to create. A lot of courage to allow silence to build up and not be afraid of the silence. A lot of patience. And patience is another thing in meditation which I wanted to point out this morning. Because sometimes people, you've been waiting to get deep meditation. You've been very patient, so you think. But it's the wrong type of patience you've been practicing. That's why I saw many years ago there are two types of patience. One is waiting for something to happen. That's not patience. That's craving. And the other one is waiting in this moment. Waiting for something to happen is just sitting here. Okay, I'm making peace. I'm being kind, being gentle. Why isn't it happening? Ajahn Brahm, I'm complaining. You are literally waiting for some result to come. Waiting for a jhana, waiting for peace, waiting for something to happen. That is called waiting in the future. And because there's a little bit of future there, you never find any peace. So don't just sit there. And when's it going to happen? I'm not peaceful yet. That's waiting in the future. And that's just another form of craving, and that doesn't work. Instead, we have waiting in this moment. Or sometimes I change it to waiting on this moment. So whatever you're experiencing now, you are like a waiter at a restaurant, just waiting on this table called now. So you see what the people in the restaurant, what they need. You know when they finish their first course, so you can actually take it away. Imagine you're a waiter at a restaurant, and they're halfway through their salad, and you yank it away. You're not going to get a tip. You know, when you pull the plate away, when they're only half finished. Now you've got to wait for them. Sometimes they take a long time, sometimes a short time. And sometimes they don't finish it because they're not going to finish it, they don't like it. A waiter is very sensitive in the moment. And that way they're waiting on this moment. And then it's amazing, they get a great tip at the end. So we wait on the mind right now. What does it need? Not what am I going to get in the future. What does it need right now? And that way that we can have this beautiful peace and kindness and gentleness. We're not ever waiting for something to happen. We're waiting on this moment to see what's necessary, what's required. And we know that if it's more peace, a bit more kindness, a bit more gentleness, we know we're making a good karma. And eventually we get the tip, the beautiful meditations. So this is not just teaching us how to meditate, it's also teaching us about how to live our life. You know, in our live our life, building up a monastery, building up a Dharmasara or a Santi monastery, you know, building up a jhana grove, building up your life, building up your career, building up a business, whatever you're building up, a relationship. It takes a lot of work in this moment. But you have this great trust, as long as you're doing it in the right way, making peace with your partner, making peace with yourself, being kind, being gentle. You know that it's going to be incredibly wonderful results in the future. So you don't think of the future in the sense of, oh, this is where I want to be. You always remember that in this present moment, this is where the future is being made. This is the only time you have for the future. And this is how you realize, in a sense, there's no control. But there is a law of karma. You can do it, but you know how to put in the causes. So the effects come. You know how to do the work, and eventually the paycheck must come. So if the paycheck hasn't come yet, please know it is in the mail. As I always used to say. And then we have a much better way of dealing with the life outside. We cannot control what our husband says, what our wife says. We cannot control what the boss says. We cannot control the weather. It rains at the wrong times. It's sunny at the wrong times. Whatever happens, we realize that we can never control things. Craving leads to suffering. What we can do is make peace with things. We can care for things. And that is the way of Buddhism. That is also the way of meditation. And you can finally get into incredibly still and peaceful states of mind. And when you do get into those peaceful states of mind, another little thing which should have mentioned at the beginning, haven't done, I apologize. And it's something which I always say when I give a talk on a Friday night, at the end of every meditation. I was there last night in Dhammalaka giving a talk. I always ask people at the end of every meditation to pause and ask how you feel at the end of every meditation. To see if instead of just finishing and getting up and doing walking or having a cup of tea, pause for a few seconds at the end of every meditation. How do I feel? Physically and mentally. And see if you can notice any change from when you started. I say this because for many years, actually when I started meditating, I was really into it as an 18-year-old. And when I got about 20, 21, I don't know what was happening, but I started to meditate less and less. Now I almost lost my meditation practice. And I always remember, I was having a cup of coffee somewhere, I can't actually remember where, and I was having a cup of coffee in this cafe and I was sitting next to a French guy. I don't know if it was you, Elaine, probably not, but nevertheless. I thank this French guy for actually saving my meditation practice. Because I, you know, we're talking, I said, yeah, I used to meditate too, I was telling him, but not so much these days, there's so many other things to do. He said, well, why aren't you meditating? He said, well, you know, you're not getting much out of it these days. He says, are you? And he was the one who asked me, he said, at the end of your meditation, just ask yourself, are you any better than when you started? I never thought of that. I always just meditated and finished and went off and did something else. I never stopped to realize the benefit I was getting. And when I followed this guy's advice and started reflecting after every meditation, I found every meditation I'd made some improvement. Every meditation I was more peaceful than when I started. It may not have been jhanas, it may not have been nimittas or great bliss states, but it was good. And even those meditations before I thought were bad meditations, when I looked at them, actually they weren't that bad at all. I'd made a lot of progress, even if I was restless and tired. Or tired, sorry, not both at the same time. But I realized at the end of the meditation there was a very discernible increase in my relaxation and state of peace. I got some positive feedback, and that encouraged me to meditate more regularly. And I still do that today, and I ask you to. When you meditate, you may think quarter of an hour, half an hour, no, it's not a good meditation this time. Pause. Have you made much progress since, you know, the beginning of the meditation? Half an hour ago and now, what's the difference? And you'll find, yes, you have made some progress. And the next thing which I taught myself to do was at the end of the meditation, I check what progress I've made, and there's always some really good progress there. Even the worst meditation is still good progress. And then I ask why, what worked and what didn't work in the meditation. I'm looking back, and there's a word for that in part, it's called pachawekanayana. It's reflecting wisdom, where you've done something, you reflect back to see what worked, what didn't work. And that's where you get all the wisdom of meditation. You learn the tricks which work and what doesn't work. And you always find every time I wanted something, I strived, I was excited or afraid, I blew it time and time again. And that was the reason why. And when I recognized that was the reason why, I looked back and saw, yeah, that was a mistake. I learned from the mistakes, so I repeated them less and less often. And every now and again, you got this really nice meditation. Why? It was nothing to do with the place. It was nothing to do with the time of day or the posture even. Sometimes it was just that I was content and I never wanted things. And I could actually see that in the practice. I look back and it's a beautiful meditation. Why? I never expected anything. Never wanted anything. I wasn't striving anymore. A lot of times they say you're just sitting here killing time, realizing you're not going to get anywhere. So you just sit here. Never forget this one lady. I won't say who she is, but many of you know her very well. At one of the retreats I was giving in Phuket some years ago, and she was one of these ladies really trying hard. She'd been meditating for many years, very devout Buddhist from Malaysia, and she was meditating all the retreat, absolutely perfect conditions, and getting nowhere. The end of the retreat came, we did the last chanting and loving kindness meditation, which I usually do. Very nice, but that was it. So she had her dinner, her lunch, and after lunch, I think the taxi, which was going to take her to the airport to take her back to Kuala Lumpur, you know, it was not going to come in another hour and a half. So she had an hour and a half to kill. The retreat was over. Finished, not getting anywhere. Quite frustrated and disappointed. She had an hour and a half to kill. Oh, might as well meditate. When she came out of meditation, she came up to me. I remember I was sitting down on a chair. She was squatting on the floor. Ajahn Brahm, at last, Ajahn Brahm. Oh, it was so lovely. She was gushing. And I remember, it was such a sweet moment. You know, she got her first deep meditation. And I said, why did it happen now? You've been meditating for 9 days, getting up early, staying up late, great teachings, great sort of encouragement. Why now? I say, tell you why now, is because for a start you weren't trying, you were just killing time. instead of trying to meditate and trying to get someone. That is why. And she understood that. She understood that for so many meditations, for 9 days, she was trying to get somewhere. And I made her reflect back. Why did it happen now? So she learned from the experience, the insight, that when you let go, you get very peaceful. And the insight, what was letting go? Sometimes you give talk after talk after talk until you're sick of the word letting go. And it's because you still haven't got it yet. So that's why I have to keep pressing it. And when you keep pressing on this letting go, eventually, sooner or later, you have to. Something clicks. And you don't need to talk about letting go anymore because you've understood it. You've seen it. And everything gets so peaceful and so still so quickly. Sometimes that's what I call it, pushing the letting go button. Like another little simile. I don't know if I've given this simile already. It's really hard being a meditator to try and to explain these things. Put it into words so other people can really grasp what's happening and maybe do it. And it's just like this person who is trying to cross the river. And they're going up and down, parallel to the stream. And they turn around and go back again. And they turn around, always 180 degree turns, back and forth, parallel to the river. And they never get across. Until someone just says, instead of turning around 180 degrees, try 90 degrees. Try doing something you've never done before. Turn perpendicular to the river. And when they turn perpendicular to the river, they realize they can just step across it. It's that narrow. And that's not the best simile, but it's sometimes all you can make up. That on this shore, that we go up and down, up and down, up and down, up and down. We don't know what letting go is. We're either doing something or trying not to do things. Always trying something. Doing something is going upstream. Trying not to do things is going against the stream. And we don't, instead, haven't really figured out how to go across the stream. Not craving, not stopping craving, but doing nothing. And we step over, we let go. You know, that's how close you are. And sometimes people think, oh, not me, I can't get jhanas, I can't get enlightened, it's just too far away. But it's incredible how damn close you are. You need to turn you around a tiny bit, see things in a different way, give up, and then you let go and you're over. That's how close people are. But how they can spend lifetimes just going up and down, craving or trying to stop craving. But never going the third option, which is going across. The perpendicular option, which very few people know what to do and how to do it. But every now and again, you do that, and it's incredible when that happens. You actually do learn what letting go is. And if there's anything you ever learn in life, pressing the letting go button once and realizing its power is just probably worth your whole life. To understand that insight of what it's like for once not to control, not to actually to let things be, let things go. And there's so many fascinating experiences, incredible experiences when you do let go. I already mentioned that one lady's, you know, knowing the book Open the Door of Your Heart, I told the story of the pain of toothache one night. Nothing worked, it was driving me crazy, no way you could sleep. No medicine, no doctors, no phones in miles around. So you're stuck in the jungle, going crazy with a toothache until eventually I couldn't stand it any longer. So I let go. You've heard this word so many times, just like you've heard it, ad nauseum, literally. You haven't thrown up yet. That's not what I mean by letting go. Not in the hall anyway, in the toilet, okay. But, because you had no other choice, your back was against the wall. You did let go. And no exaggeration, just a fraction of a second, what was one moment agony, just turned into bliss. When you let go, it's unbelievable you can do such things. And that really taught me about pain, sickness, and many things in life. If you can only fire that letting go button, it is the most powerful button in the whole mind. Just stop fighting these things. And you hear and read in the sutras there, the Buddha says, there are two thorns which people are penetrated by, the physical thorn, sometimes calls it the arrow or the dart, and the mental arrow. And most people with pain and sickness, upset, they've got the mental arrow and the physical arrow. And he said, the physical arrow you can't really do too much about, it's part of having a body, you get sick, it will hurt. The mental arrow, you can easily take out. I don't want to be in pain. I don't want to be tired. I don't want to be here. I'm the wafers. And I think you know what I mean in your own mind that sometimes happens. If I could only get into your mind and record it and play it back to people. I don't want to be in another talk. I don't want to have it. I want to go somewhere else. But anyhow, there is that letting go button. You press that letting go button. In other words, you take out the mental arrow. And I don't want. You're at peace with the pain. You're at peace with the toothache. You let go, try to control it, get rid of it, change it. That whole thing you let go of. And it's amazing when you really do press that letting go button, you're at peace. Because how easy this is. What's the problem with pain? I don't want it. That's the problem. It's understandable, especially when it's chronic pain. But then there comes a time you say, I want it. I'm here. I'm going to embrace it. I've opened the door of my heart to it. I'm going to let it be. And that works with pain. You get blissed out almost immediately. And that also works with mental defilements too. You know, the restlessness, sloth and torpor. You know, you've not being able to focus on things. Stop trying to focus. Let it be. Let this moment be. Stop trying to change it. Stop trying to get rid of it. And then you find when you press that letting be button or letting go button, your mind gets so peaceful and so still and powerful, you bliss out. That's why you keep talking about letting go. Because the more you talk about it, the more chance there is, especially when you get really frustrated, that you press that letting go button and you just give up. Let it be. There are many people who come on retreats such as these. They do get jhanas. And the first few people who got jhanas, when I was really impressed that, yeah, it does work. It's not just me, they can teach this method, it works for other people as well. And then I used to ask them, I never do it anymore. So I know the answer. I said, what did you do this time? And you know what they always used to tell me, until I stopped asking? They always used to say, this is how they got into the deep meditations. They say, I really let go this time. They always say, I really let go. I let it go properly. I did it completely. And the reason I tell you that story, because that is the trick, that is the key. To really let go. 100%. Not 99.9%. Not sort of, I'm going to let go, let go, let go. Nothing's happening. You understand, that's not letting go at all. That's using letting go as a strategy to get what you want. It's just another type of craving. And you really, 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 really let go, 100%. Then people tell you, they said that's what caused their jhanas. It's very fast, too. There's a slow way of doing it, which I've been telling you, but there's also an incredible rapid way. Just totally let go, whoosh, and you get into an incredibly deep state of mind. I did tell you the story, I'm sure, the first day. But it's one of the great stories of the little novice in Thailand, in Wat Pa Phong, listening to a talk. It's maybe a nice time now towards the end of the one of the last talks. You've been listening to so many talks, it's getting late. And maybe like this little novice, you're thinking, when is Ajahn Brahm going to stop? I've had enough, I want to go to the toilet, I want to have a cup of tea. And I am a very kind monk. Ajahn Chah, he would go on for hours. He didn't mind if he was going over lunch. He didn't mind if it was going on to 11, 12, 1 o'clock in the morning. He would just keep on talking and talking and talking. And because of the respect in Asia, no one was allowed to leave until Ajahn Chah finished. You couldn't even go to the toilet. You had to sit there until he was finished. And we got used to that because, you know, we're tough monks. But, you know, in Thailand and also in Sri Lanka, they ordain as little guys as monks and nuns, you know, the 9, 10, 11-year-olds. And there's one of these little fellows, 10 or 11 years of age, because maybe his family were too poor, his father died of an accident or something, they put him in a monastery. At least he gets fed, he gets an education, and gets a good upbringing. And they usually leave when about 15 or 16. But at least it's a nice little social safety net for them in those early years. So he was having to listen to one of Ajahn Chah's talks, which went on and on and on. If you think that I repeat myself, you should have heard Ajahn Chah. He would have one theme, and it would last about 2 weeks, the same story every time. And it took about 2 weeks cycle, then you get a new one. And so you'd hear it again, 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 again. For those of you, and I say you read sort of Ajahn Chah's books, you are so lucky because they have been filtered. All the rubbish stuff and repetitions have all been taken out. And just out of all those hours and hours of talk, just the creme de la creme, the essence, the beautiful one-liners, that's all we've got left. I had to sit through hours of that, just waiting for just one liner, which you just read straight away. Oh, that's good. And then you go and read the next one. Ooh. But anyhow, it was one of these boring talks going on and on and on and on. Because this is actually how we were trained. You know, you say, it doesn't matter if you give a good talk or a bad talk. You don't judge it. You just give a talk. And there was that story of poor old Ajahn Sumedho. I really felt so sorry for him when he told me this story. It was one of the Poya nights, the one prayer nights in Thailand. The nights when about 1,000 people would go to the temple to listen to a Dhamma talk. And this time, Ajahn Chah said, Sumedho, you go and give the talk for 1 hour. And his Thai was not that good. But he managed to get by after 1 hour, you know, say a bit of this, a bit of that, whatever Thai he knew. And people, you know, were very thankful. They saw a Western monk giving a Dhamma talk, so they were appreciative. And he got through the hour, which is a long time to give a talk in a foreign language. And then he said, okay, finish now. He got to go down. Ajahn Chah said, no, stay up there, give another hour. Oh, God. So he was really scraping the barrel, trying to think of some more things to say for an hour. And during the second hour, most of the people left anyway. There's only a few people remaining. But he managed it. He managed to get through the second hour. And he got to go down. And Ajahn Chah said, another hour! And because you're a teacher, you have no choice. So he's trying to think of something to say. The pauses were longer than the talks. We're trying to think of something more to say. And by this time, everyone except Ajahn Chah, a couple of monks and a couple of old ladies who were fast asleep anyway, the only ones left. And so he finally did it, got through the 3 hours. Another hour! Oh, God. We had to do 4 hours, and the last hour was the worst torture for everybody, except Ajahn Chah, who thought it was very funny. He was a sadist. No, I can't say that about my teacher, I'm sorry. But but the result of that was that that monk was never afraid of giving a talk. He'd plumbed the very depths. When you go that low, every other talk is easy. So anyway, one of those really long, boring talks by Ajahn Chah. This little novice, oh, when is he going to stop? It's almost 9 o'clock. When is he going to stop? When is he going to stop? When is he going to stop? And that little novice, you know, he told everyone about it afterwards. That became like a mantra, you know, like going over and over in his head. When is Ajahn Chah going to stop? When is Ajahn Chah going to stop? When is Ajahn Chah going to stop? And what an insight is, I remember, it's like you're going up and down the road, either up the road or down the road. You can't really get across, and it's suffering both ways. And suddenly you find another direction. You go perpendicular. His little change of direction was, when am I going to stop? He thought. Just that one change of thought from when is Ajahn Chah going to stop to when am I going to stop? And that little novice stopped. And when he opened his eyes, it was many hours later, all the monks had gone. I think they'd gone on alms round. It was early in the morning. And he was just sitting there in the hall. He hadn't heard any bells, none of the chanting at the very end. He was doing the Arahang Samma, Sam Buddha at the end. All the monks getting their stuff up and leaving the hall. Hadn't heard any of that. He just blissed out of his little 12 or 13 year old head. First deep meditation. He'd let go. Just pressed the button that easily from being bored, frustrated, really sort of had enough. But that little bit of insight, when am I going to stop? He stopped. He let go. Just as easy as that. And he got in this incredible nice jhana for hours. When he woke up, oh, what a wonderful night. So that is how close you are. And it's just seeing that tiny little different way of doing things. So that's why, please don't always do things the same old way. Up the stream, down the stream, never crossing the stream. Don't be creatures of habit. Experiment. As I keep on saying to you, live on the wild side. Do things slightly different. Kangaroo hop meditation. Sit in a different place. Sit with all of your jumpers and blankets off. Whatever. Or even better, get some more blankets. Every blanket in your cottage, take and wear here and see what happens. Whatever it is. Do things slightly differently. Take the teddy bear and do teddy bear meditation. Because, there we go. That's very nice meditation. At least you have sloth and torpor, you know, because the teddy bear falls off. So whatever it is. That means you can do things slightly differently. You're more aware, more mindful, and sometimes just that little word, let go. It might just click for the first time. And then you're sitting here. Lunchtime, dinner time. Tomorrow, when we leave, you'll still be sitting here. Next week, middle of the week, you're still sitting here. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Well done. So that's what's there. That's how close you are. And keep making peace, being kind, being gentle. You keep building up the karma. It's going to happen. No worries. Sadhu. Sadhu. Wait for it, wait for it. Waiting in the moment, not waiting for it. Sadhu. Very good. So have a great morning. And don't forget to give up.